British government says it's considering deploying the military to deal with disruptions caused by plant stress. Hamas says that its missile response to Israeli airstrikes on Gaza shows the Palestinian resistance will not allow Tel Aviv to change regional equations. The U.S. defense chief says that Washington will not let China use its power to reshape the international order. I'm Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. The British government is considering seeking the military's help during planned strikes, including by National Health Service. The Conservative Party chairman says the government wants minimal disruption to key public services. Britain has witnessed back-to-back strikes across different sectors for months. The action has spread to the health sector, with nurses in England and ambulance workers in England and Wales planning to stop work later this month. Under pressure, the government of Prime Minister Rishi Sunak is reportedly even considering plans to curb the right to strike. Britain's woes are part of the wider economic crisis in Europe. This is triggered by the inflation and surging energy prices that came on the heels of Western sanctions on Russia over the war in Ukraine. Okay, let's get some more information on that. So from London, I'm joined by our correspondent, Robert Carter. Rob, good to have you with us. So tell us about this NHS plan to strike. So what is it that they want? And why shouldn't the government try to do something to address their requirements instead of even thinking of banning strikes?
Well, basically, many people in the UK are not happy at the moment. There is, of course, ongoing economic crises which have plagued the British economy for quite some time now. And, you know, things like inflation are on the rise, cost of living, things are more expensive now. And people in many sectors feel as if their wages are not increasing in order to keep up with inflation, with price demands. So, public sectors, especially like the NHS, are basically feeling the real squeeze. Their pockets are being pinched very much so, and they feel that they have been there during the hardest times, like, for example, during the COVID lockdown period, the pandemic. They were serving on the front lines, trying to keep people alive during that horrific episode. And what they're essentially rather being rewarded for their dedication and their hard work, they're actually, in their mind, being punished with a lack of support from the government to help get them through this economic crisis, to help basically give them a wage that they can live off of. That's quite frankly it. There are other issues as well, but it's not just the NHS which are pushing for protest, pushing for strike action. It's actually other sectors as well. Just last week, there was a postal strike. I think that was the second in about 2 weeks of action planned by the Postal Service here. More is potentially planned in the lead up to Christmas, which of course is a busy time where people are sending gifts all over the country. And also there's been a lot of talk about rail strikes, things like that. So This is a nationwide issue. Strike action has become so regular and is hampering day-to-day life so much so for the government that, yes, as you rightly mentioned, they're talking about now curbing the rights of people to protest, especially in the public services, because they have a lot of power to shut things down at a time when the government is already trying to push through controversial policies, controversial new laws, controversial new taxes on the horizon, that type of thing. And obviously, if the country just stops working, that proves to be devastating for this new government led by the relatively new Prime Minister Rishi Sunak. So obviously, there is a new clash on the horizon, and as the months roll on and it comes into Christmas, colder times of month, the cost of energy, the living crisis, the crisis of living continues to get worse, then of course we're likely to see more protest action and perhaps a big reaction from the government as well to curb those many protests as well.
Okay, Robert, if you could also tell us about how people and also experts think, economists think about what Rishi Sunak is planning to do with the British economy.
Sure. Well, obviously, going forward, Rishi Sunak has been pretty straightforward and honest about what to expect. Higher tax increases, definitely. A lack of public spending. Cuts, in fact, in that area are likely to take place. And basically, Rishi Sunak's, well, at least his government, has been informing the NHS and the strike unions and so on that basically, as much as the government potentially could want to give them a pay rise, they just can't afford it right now. That's their excuse. Now, it's up to the viewers whether they believe that position or not. But the fact of the matter is that this government is all about pulling back and cutting costs and pulling back on spending and handing out pay increases in sectors like the NHS is not something that they're particularly interested in doing. So it's going to be a very bitter battle. I think that obviously the NHS tends to get a lot of public support because everyone, you know, relies on the NHS so much. So it's going to be a very unpopular position for the government to take if they take a real hardline, uncompromising stance towards the NHS and towards other public sector strike action as well, potentially. The train service, not so much, because people get frustrated when they want to just get to work and earn money themselves. So a harder fight for the train unions, I think, to keep their action going. But for the NHS, it's a different kettle of fish altogether.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Robert Carter, our correspondent in London. Now, staying with Europe, France saying that the West should respect Russia's need for security guarantees if Moscow agrees to negotiate ending the war in Ukraine. President Emmanuel Macron says that Europe needs to prepare its future security architecture, adding that Moscow's concerns must also be addressed. Macron says that the West has to prepare how to give security guarantees to Russia and at the same time protect its allies. The United States and Russia say that they are open to talks, but Moscow says that West support for Ukraine, including NATO enlargement and missile deployment near its borders, have to stop before any negotiations could take place.
The U.S. president said on Thursday that he would be willing to speak to Vladimir Putin if he truly wants to end the war. That was the first time he had expressed willingness to speak with the Russian leader since the beginning of the war in February, around which time he said that he will not be speaking with Putin. He made his comments as he was delivering a speech at a joint White House news conference with French President Emmanuel Macron. Here's what he said about the war in Ukraine and the unrealistic conditions under which he would speak to Putin.
Look, there's one way for this war to end, the rational way. Putin to pull out of Ukraine, number one. But it appears he's not going to do that. But the fact of the matter is, I have no immediate plans to contact Mr. Putin. Mr. Putin, let me choose my words very carefully. I'm prepared to speak with Mr. Putin if, in fact, there is an interest in him deciding he's looking for a way to end the war. He hasn't done that yet.
Biden further added, if that's the case, in consultation with my French and my NATO friends, I'll be happy to sit down with Putin to see what he has in mind, as he and Macron vowed long-term support for Ukraine. The Kremlin took note of Biden's comments and responded through its spokesman, Dmitry Peskov. He said that Putin remains open to negotiations, but he is not going to pull his troops out of Ukraine. Peskov emphasized another unrealistic condition that Biden had set for talking with Putin. That would be the West's refusal to recognize the quote-unquote new territories that Russia annexed during the controversial September referendums. All that said, Peskov was not dismissive of the potentiality of talks between the two superpowers. While outlining Russia's conditions for the talks, he said, President Putin has been, is, and remains open for contacts for negotiations. Of course, the most preferable way to achieve our interests is through peaceful diplomatic means. While it is difficult to assess both parties' actual willingness to talk, what is objectively true is the fact that President Biden had not expressed any willingness to sit down with Putin with or without the unrealistic conditions he set. Could it be that the very difficult winter ahead of Ukraine and the rest of Europe is making the West reconsider negotiating with Putin?
German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has spoken to President Putin on the phone to call for peace talks, also French President Macron, in the course of a joint White House press conference with his U.S. counterpart, emphasized the pursuit of peace talks.
While President Biden was playing fast and loose with the idea of holding peace talks and simultaneously setting unrealistic prerequisites for it, President Macron expressed a more dovish tone by simply saying, "I will continue to talk to President Putin," as he called for efforts, quote, "to prevent escalation and to achieve concrete results." Macron also stated that Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has also shown, quote-unquote, real willingness to pursue peace. Elsewhere in Europe, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz spoke with President Putin on the phone and urged the Russian leader to find a diplomatic solution to the war as soon as possible. Scholz also called for the Russian troops to fully withdraw from Ukraine, an unlikely scenario to unfold. Putin told Scholz on the phone that Germany and the entire Western Bloc's approach towards Ukraine was destructive, as he called on Scholz to rethink his approach. It is unclear whether or not Germany, France, or the U.S. would initiate peace talks with Russia, but it seems that, at the very least, they are leaving the option on the table, despite some major disagreements between the two sides on the prerequisites for the talks. Something that was expected to hurt the potentiality of peace talks, but doesn't seem to now, is the price cap that was going to be imposed on Russian oil by the G7, EU, and Australia. They have, in fact, imposed the price cap at $60 per Russian crude oil barrel, but the amount is actually well above what Russian oil is trading for right now. This means that Russian oil will still flow, and that the West has not been able to find an alternative source to Russian oil, as Russia is still the major oil provider for the countries setting the price cap. The chair of Russian Lower House's Foreign Affairs Committee, Leonid Slutsky, believes that the price cap will only end up jeopardizing EU's energy security as the world waits to see how Russia will react to the move.
Palestinian resistance movement Hamas condemning Israel's latest attack on the Gaza Strip, saying it has responded with missile fire. The movement says that the regime will never succeed in hindering the Palestinian struggle with its terrorist and Nazi behavior. Israeli warplanes attacked the Gaza Strip late on Saturday, causing damage to houses and several facilities in Khan Yunis and Rafah. The regime says it is sort of response to rocket fire from the territory. Our correspondent in Gaza, Ashraf Shannon, joined us a short while ago for more on the latest Israeli airstrikes on the besieged Strip.
Then Israeli fighter jets attacked Hamas security posts east of the southern Gaza Strip town of Rafah and west of the southern Gaza Strip town of Khan Yunis, because of extensive damage to those locations. While Hamas sources said that the attack targeted farmlands, the Israeli regime claims that they attacked targeted military tunnels and training center, as well as arms manufacturing areas in southern Gaza. The Israeli regime claims that the airstrikes were retaliation for area. Fire that was fired from the Gaza Strip, although no one has claimed responsibility for firing such a rocket, while Israeli media was saying that those who fired the rocket were members of the Islamic Jihad's military wing, Al-Quds Brigades, in retaliation for the brutal killing of a young man in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus by an Israeli soldier.
In the meantime, Palestinian activists and social media users calling for a response to the Israeli killings and crimes committed against them. The demand that Palestinians step up resistance and fight the occupation. The campaign has been launched in reaction to footage emerging of an Israeli soldier shooting a 23-year-old man four times at point-blank range at a checkpoint in Nablus. The man was left bleeding to death while Israeli forces prevented medics from reaching him. Reacting to that incident, the UN Special Coordinator for the Middle East Peace Process is calling for those responsible to be held accountable. Tor Wennesland says an immediate investigation should be conducted into the Israeli killing of Palestinians. Hamas has also vowed revenge. A correspondent, Mona Kendall, says Israeli troops are under orders by their military commanders to shoot and kill Palestinians.
Everyone knows very well, not only the Palestinians, the European Union, the international community, know very well that Israeli soldiers are using their guns to shoot and kill people. They have clear orders from the Israeli military establishment, knowing at the end of the day, none of the Israeli forces who commit crimes against unarmed people would be tried or would be taken to court to achieve justice. That's why if the Israelis continue and go on with this policy, then they themselves would be dragging the whole area to another circle of violence, returning back to, another form of an armed uprising, not only a popular intifada.
The United States suggesting it's ready to use military power to maintain its international dominance that's being challenged by China. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin made a comment as the Pentagon unveiled its latest stealth bomber, the B-21 Raider. Austin said that China has both the will and the power to reshape the U.S.-dominated international order. But he warned that Washington won't let that happen. Austin said that the U.S. is aligning its military budget to the China challenge. Washington and Beijing have been locked in tensions over a host of issues, including what China calls the threat posed by the U.S. strategic shift to East Asia. Beijing says it's ready to use its military strength to dash attempts to challenge its rising power. And that's the end of this news bulletin from Tehran.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Current world order will be replaced by a new order where US is isolated, Asia powerful, resistance front expanded. This is the part of a speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution during a meeting with students on Wednesday, November 2nd, 2022. This meeting was held on the occasion of National Students' Day and National Day of Fighting Against Global Arrogance, which are commemorated on the 13th of Aban, 4th of November. The Americans currently have bases in many different regions, including our region, in Europe, in Asia. They have populated military bases whose expenses are paid by taking money from the poor country in which the base is located. These countries are expected to cover the expenses while the Americans sit back and lord over them. This will be over soon. The United States will have to pack its bags and leave these different places in the world. This is the first main line of the basic lines that form the new order of the future world. The second basic line is the transfer of political, economic, cultural, and even scientific power from the West to Asia. Today, Western powers have political authority, scientific authority, cultural authority, and economic authority. They have many things. However, perhaps a more accurate interpretation would be to say they had these things, but are gradually losing them. But they had these for many years. The West acted like this for two or three centuries. In the new order, this state will be transferred from the West to Asia. Asia will become the center of knowledge, the center of economics, as well as the center of political power and the center of military power. And we are in Asia. That is the second point.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The third basic line includes the expansion of the idea of resistance and the resistance front against coercion. The initiator of this is the Islamic Republic, because ever since the Industrial Revolution took place and the Europeans started advancing and colonizing other countries, they made the people and the countries of the world get used to the fact that submission and dominance are two inevitable corresponding parts of the world.
Allah, I wanna thank you. That you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The UN General Assembly has voted in favor of a pro-Palestinian resolution to commemorate the Nakba, or Catastrophe Day, which marks the Israeli regime's claiming existence in 1948. The Assembly adopted the resolution with 90 votes in favor, 30 negative votes, and 47 abstentions. The initiative was sponsored by Egypt, Jordan, Senegal, Tunisia, Yemen, and the Palestinians, and was approved despite the opposition of the US, UK, and Israel, and most European Union countries. 47 states abstained. The UN resolution calls for a, quote, commemoration of the 75th anniversary of the Nakba, including by organizing a high-level event at the General Assembly Hall in May 2023. The resolution also urges the dissemination of relevant archives and testimonies. Nakba Day, or Day of Catastrophe, falls on May 15 of each year. The date commemorates events that led to the Israeli regime forcibly expelling hundreds of thousands of Palestinians from their homes, in order to make way for the Israeli settlers 74 years ago.
Regrettably today, in the absence of a just solution, 75 years since the General Assembly's decision to partition historic Palestine with the adoption of Resolution 181 Roman II and the prolongation of Israel's occupation now for over 55 years, the Palestinian people, including the Palestine refugees, continues to experience increasing levels of dispossession, displacement, violence, human rights violations, and insecurity.
The General Assembly also adopted other resolutions on the question of Palestine. They called for an immediate halt to settlement activities, land confiscation and home demolitions, the release of prisoners, and an end to arbitrary detentions.
The ongoing expansion of by Israel, by the occupying power, of illegal settlements in the occupied Palestinian territory, including East Jerusalem, and the attendant settler violence, which is also on the rise, need decisive action. These illegal actions constitute grave breaches of international law and are a flagrant obstruction of the right of the Palestinian people to self-determination.
Separately, the UN General Assembly adopted a resolution regarding the Syrian Golan Heights, which the Israeli regime has been occupying for more than half a century. The resolution has demanded the withdrawal of the regime from that area. It called on Israel to implement the resolutions of the Security Council and to withdraw from the Golan to the line of June 4, 1967. On Thursday, Israeli forces killed two Palestinians during a raid near the city of Jenin in the northern part of the occupied West Bank. Before raiding Jenin, Israeli forces attacked the town of Yabad, southwest of Jenin, and killed a 22-year-old man there. This is not an isolated act of violence against Palestinians. Israeli occupation forces have ramped up military activity in the West Bank, killing more Palestinians during the past months. Since the start of 2022, Israeli troops have killed more than 200 Palestinians, including more than 50 children in the occupied West Bank and East Al-Quds, as well as the besieged Gaza Strip. That is the highest record of killings since the year 2006.
In 2022, we have witnessed a dangerous escalation in Israeli military raids across the occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem, leading to the killing and injury of more civilians, including women and children.
And none of the soldiers have been investigated to any of the crimes. This is a clear indication how the policy of the coming Israeli cabinet will be: more killings and more aggression.
Israeli officials have described the security situation in the occupied West Bank as dangerous. They've even suggested that the regime could face another intifada or uprising. Palestinians have vowed to respond against Israel's acts of aggression. On November 23, two separate explosions rocked two bus stations at the entrance of occupied Al-Quds. The blasts were in response to a long period of ongoing Israeli oppression of the Palestinian people. The tensions come as Israel is about to have one of the most extreme right-wing cabinets in the coming weeks. The cabinet, which is headed by Benjamin Netanyahu, is controversial due to the controversial Israeli politicians who've been mired in corruption and controversies. France and the United States are considered longtime allies with lots of cultural commonalities. But when it comes to trade, there are signs that the two longtime allies are heading for a confrontation. The French President Emmanuel Macron is visiting the United States on an official visit to boost ties. But during his trip there, Macron had some tough words directed against Washington for what he described as U.S. protectionism for its own industries. Emmanuel Macron is warning that the newly announced U.S. industrial subsidies could split the West. Macron arrived in Washington on Tuesday for his second state visit to the U.S. since taking office in 2017. French officials say Macron will confront President Joe Biden over the subsidies contained in the Inflation Reduction Act. The controversial act was signed by President Joe Biden back in August, and the Biden administration signed that with the Democratic-controlled Congress in a bid to boost U.S. domestic production and create more jobs there.
To a groundbreaking chips and science law that's going to ensure that technologies and jobs of the future are made here in America. In America. And all this progress is part of our vision and plan and determined effort to get the job done for the American people.
Well, things started really well off with Joe Biden. There was a lot of, you know, handshaking and shoulder rubbing. We're in this together and extremely friendly relations until AUKUS. AUKUS, obviously, was lived in France like a major betrayal. And it was painful, and nobody tried to hide, you know, how feelings were hurt.
France is not the only European nation to complain about the U.S. Inflation Reduction Act. Many European leaders have also complained about the legislative package. They say the package unfairly disadvantages non-American companies and would be a serious blow to their economies. The legislation could potentially be disastrous for car makers, especially in Germany and in France. Berlin and France have warned that if Washington does not scale back, they will introduce countermeasures against the United States. European leaders are mulling over the idea of a Buy European Act, just like the Americans. Germany, which is considered the EU's economic powerhouse, has also supported the French calls for more protection for European businesses and manufacturers. There are now talks of countermeasures similar to the U.S. scheme if Washington refuses to address key concerns. Brussels has made it clear that the U.S. legislation to subsidize its own businesses at the expense of its European partners represents a form of economic protectionism that undermines the rules of the World Trade Organization. The controversial act in the Biden administration comes after 4 years of rocky relations between the U.S. and Europe during the tenure of the former President Donald Trump.
Well, during the Trump presidency, the European-American, the French-American relation was quite conflictual and difficult because in the White House was a president who didn't believe in alliance, who undermined NATO every step of the way, even talked about, you know, NATO being obsolete and there was, according to him, a need to move on. He stepped out of the climate agreement on climate. He stepped out of a negotiation on the Iran nuclear program. Everybody remembers that Emmanuel Macron tried to soften somehow Donald Trump, and that it didn't work out.
Furthermore, on the U.S.'s discriminatory policies against the EU are seen as particularly harmful at a time when the world faces an economic slowdown because of the COVID-19 pandemic, the Ukraine war, and trade bottlenecks. It is now believed that the U.S. is using the war in Ukraine to its own advantage by imposing its will on the EU.
Last week, the UN Human Rights Council convened a meeting at the request of Germany and Iceland to discuss alleged human rights violations in Iran during the handling of recent riots in the country. The intergovernmental body voted to establish an independent international fact-finding mission to investigate the purported abuses. In reaction, Tehran has dismissed the move. Iran's foreign ministry said the country will not cooperate with the mission, stressing that it has already formed a national fact-finding committee to look into the events. Spokesman Nasser Kanani made the remarks at a press briefing in the Iranian capital of Tehran as he showed up with a chemical mask in the presser, which alluded to Germany's support for Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein during the 1980 to 1988 Iraqi-imposed war on Iran. Kanani lashed out at Germany for co-sponsoring the anti-Iran resolution at the Geneva-based Council, saying Germany is the same country that supplied chemical weapons to the former Iraqi Ba'ath regime during the 1980s war with Iran. Official reports indicate that in 1980, under the rule of former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein, Baghdad purchased over 1,000 tons of mustard agents from the West. Germany, the US, the UK, Italy, and the Netherlands were among the countries providing the Ba'athist regime with equipment and material to build chemical weapons. Over 350 large-scale chemical attacks on Iran-Iraq border between 1980 to 1988 on soldiers and civilians left Iran with more than 100,000 victims. Tens of thousands died on the spot, and many more suffered for years as a result of exposure to chemical agents. Elsewhere in his remarks, the spokesman of Iran's foreign ministry underlined that several United Nations reports have pointed to the fact that German companies were supplying the former Iraqi regime with chemical weapons. Kanani also condemned the hasty employment of human rights mechanisms and instrumental use of them against independent states, emphasizing that such an approach will not provide any help for the advancement of human rights. The Iranian Foreign Ministry has summoned German ambassador to Tehran after the UN Human Rights Council convened a meeting at the request of Berlin and passed a resolution against the Islamic Republic. The ministry conveyed Tehran's strong protest against the interventionist and baseless statements of German authorities to the ambassador. Tehran denounced the recent passage of an anti-Iranian resolution at the UN Human Rights Council over the recent developments in Iran as a wrong measure founded on a completely politicized and instrumental approach to human rights, which is categorically rejected. The collaboration of Germany and certain European countries with the unilateral coercive measures imposed by the U.S. has resulted in violation of the human rights of Iranians and strips them of any legitimacy and competence to make claims about human rights advocacy. Earlier in November, Tehran summoned the German ambassador over interventionist and irresponsible comments by the European country's head of state, Olaf Scholz, in support of the recent Western-instigated riots in Iran. Tehran blames foreign provocations for the riots in the country, saying it has provided evidence to countries whose nationals were involved in inciting unrest. The rioters have been going on a rampage across the country, attacking security forces, resorting to vandalism against public property, and desecrating religious sanctities. Earlier in the month, Iran's intelligence ministry said the United States and the United Kingdom were directly involved in the recent riots, adding that dozens of terrorists affiliated with the Zionist regime and anti-revolution groups have also been detained in the unrest. The European Union and some Western countries imposed sanctions on Iran over its approach toward the riots. Iran, in turn, announced retaliatory sanctions against institutions and individuals in the European Union due to their deliberate actions in support of terrorism and terrorist groups during the riots.
More people will die in Europe this winter because of energy costs than those who have perished on the battlefield in the Ukraine war. That's according to a research conducted by the British weekly newspaper The Economist. The research said the current cost of energy will likely lead to an extra 147,000 deaths if there is a typical winter. The British newspaper modeled the impact of a sharp increase in electricity prices in Europe on deaths during the winter. In case of mild temperatures using the warmest winter during the past 20 years for each country, this figure would fall to 79,000, and with frigid ones using each country's coldest winter since 2000, it would climb to 185,000. The analysis named the severity of the flu season and temperatures and energy prices as the main factors that affect how many people will die in Europe outside Ukraine this winter. The model forecasts deaths based on weather, demography, influenza, energy efficiency, incomes, government spending, and electricity costs, which are closely correlated to prices for a wide variety of heating fuels. Italy is predicted to have the most deaths owing to a nearly 200% rise in electricity costs since 2020 and a big aging population. According to The Economist statistics, across Europe, 28% more people aged at least 80, who account for 49% of total mortality, die in the coldest months than in the warmest ones. On average, in a winter 1 Celsius degree colder than normal for a given country, 1.2% more people die. High fuel prices can exacerbate the effect of low temperatures on deaths by deterring people from using heat and raising their exposure to cold. Given average weather, the model finds that a 10% rise in electricity prices is associated with a 0.6% increase in deaths, though this number is greater in cold weeks and smaller in mild ones. The report notes that due to Russian attacks on its infrastructure, Ukraine would suffer more civilian casualties than any other country in the model. Last week, European Commissioner for Economy Paolo Gentiloni warned that if the Ukraine war doesn't end by the time next winter hits, Europe's energy sector will face more serious risks than this year. As a result of increasing Western sanctions on Russia, the price of gas and electricity for residential houses in Europe has increased significantly. Before the war, Russia supplied 40 to 50% of the European Union's natural gas. Russian Foreign Ministry spokesperson Maria Zakharova blamed European officials for the energy crisis and lack of fuel in Europe. She said the European leaders are forced to convince their citizens that the current situation is not only good and right, but also in their own interest. The G7, including the United States as well as the entire EU plus Australia, has stepped up attempts in recent days to impose a punitive price cap on seaborne exports of Russian oil on December 5th, as part of sanctions against Moscow over its military operation in Ukraine that began on February 24th. Russian President Vladimir Putin has warned of grave consequences to the US-led scheme of introducing price caps on Russian crude oil, as the European Union nations failed to agree on a price ceiling. Around 70 to 85% of Russia's crude exports are carried by tankers rather than pipelines. And the idea of a price cap spearheaded by Washington is to ban shipping, insurance, and reinsurance companies from handling cargoes of Russian crude oil across the world unless it is sold at or below the price set by the G7 and its allies. Since the onset of the conflict, the United States and its European allies have imposed waves of economic sanctions against Moscow, while supplying large consignments of heavy weaponry to Kyiv. The Kremlin says the sanctions and the supplies will prolong the war.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is
for a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم, sisters and brothers. Welcome to a new episode of For a Better Life. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Asma at your service with a new topic. Well, this is a cozy little corner where we think how to improve our lives. Well, today, just in my way to get to the studio, I was looking at the naked trees in the sidewalks, and I started daydreaming about how rich autumn is. Now, it might sound paradoxical to the true meaning of autumn, but I think this is the truth. It is the rainy season that's full of secret. When it comes, nature will lose all its green leaves, colorful flowers, and we beat the sunny mornings for quite a while and say hello to the cloudy mornings, which, by the way, are my favorite mornings. Why am I mentioning this? Is it an introduction to a sentimental article? Am I practicing romanticism unconsciously? Well, by all the means, and with much of respect I hold for the literary schools and for the love of nature that runs in my blood, I should say no. Mentioning autumn is not just to say a bunch of touching words that would create a sentimental feeling in ourselves. No, it's not just for that. It's just to think about it and ask ourselves why after summer we go to autumn. Why after a whole long day we cross the bridge of the night. Why the sun goes behind the clouds and why the moon eventually is going to come out of the dark. Yes, I'm asking you just to think about these questions. And while we're thinking about it all together, let's go for a short break and then we'll get the answers. Welcome back, dear friends. This is For a Better Life. You are listening to the sound of A Better Life. Just some moments ago, I was talking about autumn and I asked, why does this circle happens everywhere? Why there's no way to get out of it? The chords of the piano are black and white. The notes of all the musics have ups and downs. There are light and there are dark. There is black, there is white, and a lot more that comes after one another. And it seems as if it's the structure in these opposite things come together in a harmonious accord. Well, the truth is, life is a cauldron of different things, of opposite things. The world is composed of happiness and sadness, and these things in harmony with each other make perfection come into existence. I know that right now you might call this a cliche thing, a sort of humdrum, something that we all talk about but we never feel it. Yes, I'm with you. Truly listening about these things is something very much unbelievable because when we say it, it's very easy, but when we feel it, it's very difficult. I'm with you in that department. But the thing is, well, that's the truth, and that's the reality, and there's no way to get out of it. Well, this world has been composed in this way, and just as I brought some examples for you, everything has ups and downs. Everything has two opposite sides. Like the moon, even when you look at it, it has got this bright side, and there's also the black side, the dark side that no one has to see. Each and every single one of us is just like this, and our lives are just the same. Sometimes, in some moments of our lives, in some phase of our lives, we might get into troubles that we think that, okay, I am all alone. This is only me who's going through all this much of suffering, and life is a miserable thing. Why am I living even? You know, I'm just saying that these things are normal and they happen to all the beings who live in this world. Even, I guess, the small creatures who are living beneath the sea and the oceans are suffering from the same things. So there is no peace in this world, except for those who have a great and deep connection with their Lord. Well, I know now it might sound that I'm talking about idealistic things, but again, I should say that the things that look ideal, fortunately or unfortunately, are the truth. When we say that
life has got too much of terribles. It has got sweetness in it, and it has got bitterness in it. And it's just like the thing that we call it, the sugar-coated pill. So it has got both the remedy and also it has got the bitterness in it. There's some moments that we feel like everything is done. There's nothing I could do. And everything has been collapsed around me. I have no more of happiness. But then you see that a week later, a day later, a month later, whatever, a year, 10 years, after all, and eventually you're going to get the bright side of your story as well.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
What I mean totally is that it is true that sometimes life gets so hard with us and we go through some harsh phases, but this is life for every one of us. We shouldn't look at other people as if they're living a life that is very much different from us. No, all the people have problems, all the people have happiness. So if right now you're in your dark phase, it doesn't mean that you would never see that bright phase. And vice versa, if you're living in a good day, if you are having an amazing life right now, doesn't mean that life is going to go in that cycle forever. So you shouldn't get used and accustomed to everything that you're in. If you get accustomed to the sad things that happen in your life, then chances you might get into depression. If you get accustomed to the happy things that happen in your life, then there's a big chance that one day you're going to be disillusioned. And the process of being disillusioned, again, is going to lead to depression. That's why, according to narrations of Imam Ali alayhi salam, we shouldn't be happy too much in our happy days, and we shouldn't be too sad in our sad days, because both are transitory, and this is the nature of life. So just as I mentioned at the very beginning, as the introduction of today's episode, I told you that when there is autumn, there for sure isn't a spring that would come after the winter. And when there is a day, a morning, when a morning starts, we are pretty sure about the night that is going to come after it. And then you know how the cycle works. After the night, of course, there must be a day. There must be a morning in which the sun is going to come down, and then we're going to see everything vividly. So all I mean to say is that try not to get accustomed to the sad things that happen in your life and also to the happy things that might occur in your life. Life is just like this. It has got two sides, the bitter side and the sweet side. So you can say that I'm the only one who's suffering from the bitter side of life. No, it happens to all of the people. And this actually might work like a relief when you see that every single person in this world is suffering from different issues, problems, and whatever. Well, we come to understand and realize that, okay, I'm not alone. And there's a big club like me out there. And that's it. That's life, and we have to make the best out of each and every moment by having a deeper connection with our Lord, because the thinking, the mere thought of Him being close to us is going to make everything very much easier. And we have so much of pretty narrations, even in our prayers, that tells about this relationship, that says, if it wasn't about the thought that I have about you, then I would have never tolerated all the problems that I have right now. And a lot more of these examples. Thank you for listening. Until another session, I bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land, He knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand, He knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash, He knows. Every thought I have and every word I
share, he knows. Allah knows.
Ukraine and Russia.
Part 2.
Ukraine is a prize many have sought, and much blood has spilled in the quest to possess it. Ukraine has been the pathway for Western powers as they attempted to conquer the East. Another historical document that changed the fate of Ukraine was the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact of 1939. One of many such agreements being signed between European countries and rising Germany. Attempting to protect his nation from the approaching Nazi threat, Joseph Stalin negotiated a treaty of non-aggression with Adolf Hitler. While promising each other peace, the Soviet and German foreign ministers Molotov and Ribbentrop realigned the map of Eastern Europe, splitting it into German and Soviet spheres of influence. In January 1943, USSR troops started pushing the Nazis back, liberating one part of Ukraine after another. Western Ukraine was the last Ukrainian region held by the Germans, finally being liberated in October of 1944. The era of political and military tension between the US and the USSR lasted for nearly 45 years, keeping humanity under the constant threat of nuclear war. In this battle, the United States never lost sight of Ukraine's importance. U.S. intelligence kept a close eye on Ukrainian nationalist organizations as a possible source of counterintelligence against the Soviet Union. CIA documents that just recently have been declassified show strong ties between U.S. intelligence and Ukrainian nationalists since 1946. From the CIA agency report, it is clear that they were not mistaken about the nature of Ukrainian nationalist organizations or their leader, Stepan Bandera himself. By 1954, the agency excused the illegal activities of the OUN security branch in the name of Cold War necessity. In 1949, Mykola Lebed, the man responsible for the massacres in Volhynia, was moved to the United States, where he died in 1989 without ever being investigated or pursued as a war criminal. The CIA moved to protect Ukrainian nationalist leader Mykola Lebed from criminal investigation by the Immigration and Naturalization Service in 1952. The Cold War would heat up and cool down by turns, while both rivals were obsessively building up military capacity. The turning point took place when the new era, Perestroika, came to the USSR with its new leader Mikhail Gorbachev in the middle of the 1980s. Perestroika meant restructuring towards liberalization and democratization. It certainly had a positive impact on the international situation.
Astonishing news from East Germany, where the East German authorities have said, in essence, that the Berlin Wall doesn't mean anything anymore.
But inside the USSR, the weakening of Kremlin control had different consequences. The people's growing discontent made Ukraine more vulnerable to outside forces, and a new kind of warfare was launched, one not known before, the color revolutions.
Violent clashes erupted in the Ukrainian capital Kiev as more than 100,000 people protested against a government decision to delay an association deal with the EU.
Arseniy Yatsenyuk, leader of the opposition party, Fatherland. Oleg Tagnibok, leader of the opposition nationalist far-right political party, Svoboda. Vitaly Klitschko, leader of the opposition party, UDAR.
Both EU and Ukrainian officials said on Thursday the suspension of talks on closer ties could be revived after the two-day meeting. But officials said the deal was off the table for now.
Pro-EU protests on the streets of Kiev enter their second day. The crowd of around 1,000 protesters were joined by the leader of the opposition, the reigning world boxing champion Vitaly Klitschko. He called on the demonstrators to maintain pressure on the government after it decided